Welcome to Horrorspiria. My name is May, and today we have a very special episode with an amazing guest. Please, everyone, welcome Tushe Kutnu. Hi, Tushe.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great as well. I mean, as great as I can be in this pandemic times, of course. But it's also very related to my research, you know, death and, you know, mourning and grief all around us. So I am, as a researcher, it gives me a lot of stuff to think about. But as a normal human being, I am, of course, very sad about what's going on in the world.
Oh, you are so funny. I regret that we haven't done this sooner. I needed to laugh. All right, Tushe. Well, you know, we met just, you know, doing conferences. I think we were at the same conference. I was very impressed by your work. And so we've become friends, and you have your thesis, which is so beautiful and important. And so I would prefer if you would go ahead and explain, you know, not only how you like to characterize your work, but also tell us a bit more about your thesis, please.
I did my undergrad at Ankara University, Radio, Television and Film, and I did a master's degree at Ankara University and another master's degree at UCL, University College London, in film studies. And now I'm doing my PhD at Ankara University, cinema again. And I'm a research and teaching assistant at the same university. So academia is the way to go for me, obviously. But before that, I worked briefly for a public television company like BBC, but in Turkish. My job was to read scripts, and I read a lot of scripts. Some of them were good, but some of them were... Okay. One thing you have to know about me, that I'm obsessed with horror films, and I have been obsessed with horror films like forever, like maybe 5 years old or something like that, where I watched Child's Play at night without my parents knowing. Of course, I was like, like, you watch this, oh, there's a baby. But then I was like shocked, horrified through the whole film, but that didn't affect the fact that I was now obsessed with horror films, and I wanted to watch as much as possible, as many as possible. And so in 2010, I lost my grandfather. That kind of opened up a hole in my life, and I started to think more about dying and grief. And he was sick for like 3 or 4 years. And so I started to think about dying, death, grief. What does it mean? Why are we here, and why do we leave? And all these like big questions. And after coming to, you know, university, and especially at UCL, I said, like, you have two obsessions. One is horror, one is death. Like, why don't you combine this and make a work that may be helpful to people? Because while researching, I saw that a lot of people online treat their mental health with horror films. And that's a very interesting thing, because for example, I read the research that people with anxiety disorders actually get help from horror films, from watching horror films. Wow. And that sparked something in me, like mental health and horror are so related. And you would expect, you know, a person with anxiety to feel fearful while watching horror films, right? That you wouldn't automatically assume that they would be at ease and like happy that people are getting killed. But that's something like Elizabeth Bronfen calls this death by proxy. Mm-hmm. And death by proxy is, I think, very important, because like you experience death at a safe distance through horror films. Yeah. And that kind of prepares us for what is to come in real life as well. And that I think reduces anxiety in a person, anxiety about, you know, death and what's to come after that. And so I started researching grief. I read a lot of work on, you know, psychology and psychiatry. I felt like I was a psychiatry student at one point. Like, so I researched so much of that stuff. And at last, I decided that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's much criticized work on five stages of grief was the perfect, you know, perfect structure for my thesis. So my chapter one is denial, and it talks about Midsommar, a film that I really love and a film that I think is really important regarding grief studies. And on chapter two, anger, we talk about Hereditary, another important film from Ari Aster. I think Ari Aster has something. I don't know. I'm really looking forward to the third film because I'm pretty sure that one is also that one will also have something to do with, you know, death and dying and mourning, because I think it's kind of like he's obsessed as I am. So let's see about that. And third chapter, Bargaining, is about Pet Sematary, but the latest one, 2019 adaptation of Stephen King's novel. And the reason I chose that over the original is because now Ellie is the one that died. Right. And that is very important because Gage in the original film, Gage dies. Yeah. Gage is a baby. I mean, he just, you know, murders some people. You don't get any kind of like, you don't get guilt from Louise's part because Ellie in this version talks a lot about death after she died. She's like, why don't you tell mother? And like, am I dead? Like, because she's older. And I think that's important, this research. And then on chapter four, we look at Susan Hill's adaptation, The Woman in Black, which is, I think, a recent piece on depression. Arthur Kipps is clearly depressed over his wife's demise. And finally, we come to Acceptance, which is chapter five. And we look at, of course, The Babadook, because I think The Babadook shows all the stages of grief that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross talks about with David Kessler. And the film is, the Babadook, the monster, is grief personified. So it's really important that film, I think, that film was the film that pushed me to do this research. Because I was watching that film. A friend recommended it to me, and I was watching this film, and I was like, this is a horror story, but also this is a story about love, life, loss, grief, like everything, basically. Everything is in this film. And motherly love, you know, we think that motherly love is unconditional, but the film actually tells us that that may not actually be true. And these are all important things that this film brings to the table. So it had to be in the research. Overall, this research is about grief and mourning and death and horror films, which I think that they are all related somehow.
Well, thank you for breaking that down. You know, I think that that's really helpful. And it also, it's so... It's very paralleled to the framework that you use, the Kubler-Ross framework that you use. So I think I would like to get into each chapter and each film with you, especially how you read it. But before I do that, I could, like, there are some in your list. They were like The Babadook seemed really obvious to me, Midsommar, Hereditary. And I have no doubt that choosing films for this thesis was probably difficult. So do you mind explaining like why these films are like, were there any films that you left out that you would have liked to talk about? Can you talk a little bit about the narrowing down and selection process?
Of course. I mean, I think I watched, I'm also, I stating that in the thesis as well. I watched hundreds of horror films, hundreds. I mean, you can't, I can't even remember some of them, like a lot of films, because I also have a chapter like excursion called Horror's History with Grief, which is very important because I talk about Gothic elements and how Gothic novel and, you know, grief and horror is related. They are all related somehow. And like, for example, slashers could have been another chapter if this wasn't, you know, like if I hadn't structured it according to Kubler-Ross's theory. I think slashers would have had their own chapter, because everyone assumes that slashers are, you know, guilt-free, grief-free, like people die, no one cares. And that is not true. That is not true at all. And I talk about that because while doing the research, I looked at Scream and Final Destination and Nightmare on Elm Street. I watched all of them. I watched all of the classics. And according, like on top of the classics, I watched films about grief, such as Lake Mungo, which is fantastic film about grief, and a lot of other films that you know I had to left out. But I think the most important one for me was Lake Mungo, because I felt really sad that I had to leave it out because I didn't have a place for it. Mm-hmm. And you know, dissertation rules. You know the dissertation's rule. You can't go over 12,000 words. So it was kind of. I would have talked more about Don't Look Now, for example, which is the, when you talk about, think about grief and horror, Don't Look Now, Nicholas Roeg's film, is one of the films that they immediately comes to your mind, because there's, you know, survivor's guilt, there's guilt over, you know, the children, but there's a death of a child in the film, just like Hereditary. And that's it's really important work. And I would also include Scream. Of course, I would include Final Destination, because the entire franchise is about fate and how you cannot escape death. So it's really important for grief studies. And I think Final Destination is one of the very few films, horror films, where, you know, a lot of the scenes take place during funerals.
Yeah.
which is very interesting, because, you know, in horror films, you don't usually see, in slashers, you don't see the, you know, big funeral scene, people crying and, you know, painting and all that. But Final Destination breaks that rule and shows lengthy funerals and people, you know, blaming one another. It's really fascinating that this slasher talks so much about grief and how we cannot cope with it. If we cannot cope with it, we cannot go on. Of course, I had to leave them out, but the ones that I chose, if you ask me how did you choose them? For me, of course, the one that set the fire was the Babadook, and I was very pretty sure that it had to be Acceptance, because, well, the ending. I mean, I don't want to spoil anything for anyone who's yet to see the Babadook, but I have to do a spoiler alert. If you haven't seen the Babadook, now close your ears. But the ending, you see that the Babadook is like small and, you know, helpless and in the basement, and Amelia goes to feed it. I mean, that is very symbolic, very, very symbolic. I mean, why would you, if it wasn't grief, why would you, in the name of God, why would you feed a monster living in your basement? Exactly. Because this shows us that it will never go away. Grief will never go away. And it will just get smaller. It will just get manageable. But one thing, you know, sometimes It happens. I mean, we all lost loved ones. I lost my grandmother 1 month ago to COVID, for example. And yeah, I mean, a lot of people died and she had a long life. So I'm happy about that, that she had a brilliant life. So, but, you know, sometimes I think about a film and she comes to my mind. And of course, grief doesn't go away. I mean, you can manage it quite well, but there will come a point where it will remind you that your loved one will never come back again, never. And when Amelia comes back from the basement, Sam asks, like, it's getting much better, Mom. He says, what is getting better? Grief is getting better. And Amelia is getting better at hiding, not hiding, but managing it. And that was my acceptance. I knew that. But then I started watching the films, and it was like 200 films maybe. And it was a long period. I watched a lot of them. I decided that Midsommar was denial, because definitely denies the death of her parents for quite a while. She goes to Sweden after her entire family dies. I mean, if that's not denial, what is denial? And it became pretty clear to me that this was about denial. And there are a lot of instances. For example, Pelle, the exchange student from Harga, wants to talk to her about her loss, but she's like, no, like, she just runs away. That's denial 101. I mean, she just runs away and doesn't want to talk about it, but that's her psyche's reaction. It's like kind of like a mechanism to like protect herself, because it is too much. Sometimes grief is too much, and there is suicide and there is murder in her case. And that these are unacceptable kind of deaths, because there are deaths that are acceptable, such as a death of a child, murder, you know, violent deaths. These are kind of unacceptable deaths that complicate the mourning process. And Danny has all of those. In chapter 2, I researched a lot. And I then came to the conclusion, I was watching the monologue with Toni Collette's beautiful monologue in the dinner scene with the son. Yeah. And her name is Annie, she just goes ballistic. Yeah. She goes ballistic. She's so furious. She's so angry. She's like, her face is red with anger. And I'm like, yes, I found my anger. This is the film that I will talk about. And depression was quite easy, I think, because I watched the play 2 times, one in Turkish and one in English. I came to London, The Woman in Black. When I was watching all the film, of course, I watched the film as well. I watched the sequel as well. The sequel is not that good, but I think the first one is, I would say that is a good film. It has some really interesting scenes, dramatic sequences, and it starts with Arthur Kipps having a kind of dream, and for depressed people, especially, like, because depression in grief is different from depression as we know it. Depression in grief is your body's way of trying to deal and trying to adjust and trying to move on. And he has a kind of like dream, and then you understand that this man doesn't want to wake up from the dream, because his real life is not the same without her. And I realized that, oh no, we are talking about grief and death and, you know, depression here, because after he goes to Kristin Gifford, he meets Sam Daly, and of course, his wife, Elizabeth. Elizabeth is deeply depressed, clinically depressed at that point, because of the loss of their child. And then I decided that this is the film that I have to talk about regarding depression. And bargaining was one of the easiest, actually, because how many films, horror films, have bargaining with death in them? I mean, Pet Sematary, obviously, it's very obvious. It was a very obvious choice because there's this man of science, a doctor, really, a doctor doesn't, and he doesn't even believe in afterlife. A door opens for him to the afterlife with the help of his neighbor, Jet. And it's so interesting that this man of science, after the door opens to the afterlife, he just completely changes. And of course, when Ellie dies, he cannot accept that she died. And of course, there is guilt because he could have prevented that from happening.
Well, thank you for that. First off, I never thought of Final Destination as like a funeral drama, and now I'm going to think of it in that way. But in that answer, you actually answered quite a few follow-up questions I had. So I think maybe what I want to do is kind of go film by film now. So with Midsommar and with Denial, I think you laid out exactly the causality of it very well. But I guess my question then becomes, can we talk a little bit then about the journey to the end? Because the end is really unique. It seems like Danny goes through so many different traumas in Sweden in and of itself. And then there's this ending that can be read ambiguous. But I really appreciated your interpretation of it. So, yeah, can we talk a little bit about the journey of Midsommar and the journey of Danny?
Of course. I mean, I watched both versions of the film because there's a director's cut as well, which is a little bit longer. And
what do you think of the director's cut? Do you think it's helpful?
I think it's helpful. It was helpful for me because, I mean, my introduction begins with a quote from the director's cut, and it wasn't in the original cut, so it helped a lot. It's just Christian asks Ulla and Maya about a ritual called Atestupan, and then he goes on to ask, do you have a typical period of mourning? And Ulla just answers, yeah, we grieve and we celebrate. And this is really important regarding this film, because celebration, they celebrate life, but they also celebrate death in Harga. But of course, in a Western point of view, it is very, very uncomfortable and weird to say that they celebrate death. And and as I said before, I think I mentioned it in my thesis, but I have to mention it now as well. The films that I chose were from Western Anglo-American world. Yeah. I came from an Islamic background. So for me, grief is different. I mean, we grieve for quite a long time. Our rituals are much more, complex. Yeah. So it gives the survivors a place to breathe, and people don't leave you alone. For example, they call every day and they come by your house every day. They check on you. And it's really, really, it's an important thing to not leave the family alone for at least, 40 days, because they may have, problems. And I think that also helps concerning suicides after deaths, because a lot of suicides become happen after death of a loved one. So in Islamic tradition, this is different. And then you go to Asia, you see another part of death. You see reincarnation. You see a lot of other stuff that is different from Western tradition. And then, of course, Jewish tradition is different as well. There's a thing called the vigil. And there's a movie called The Vigil as well. I completely recommend that film. That was a great film about death as well. And But Western tradition is different. After the Enlightenment, I think it became more reason rather than feelings. So Western traditions and rituals started to, you know, kind of go away. But in Harga, it's a pre-Christian pagan community, we assume. We don't get, we are a pagan community, but we kind of get the idea that they are a pre-Christian pagan community. And when Dani comes to Harga, I think she's just lost. She's in denial. I mean, there's a scene, I think it's really important. They are taking, you know, drugs. And after the drugs, she just goes, you know, into full panic attack mode, anxiety attack. And it is because Mark calls them a family. And she's triggered by that word because she lost all of them. And she has no one. She has no support system. Her boyfriend is trash. And yes, she is. I mean, let's accept that fact. He's trash. He sucks. And I mean, he didn't deserve that ending, but still, I mean, maybe he did. I mean, he gaslights her quite a lot. Maybe he did. That's true. You may be true. And then there's this journey into Sweden, and Pelle is the only one who asks her how she's feeling and, you know, if there's anything he can do to help. No one else asks her that question. I mean, that girl just lost her entire family and no one is asking how she is. And that is very problematic. And this is why also I say that she doesn't have a support system. She has people around her, yes, but she doesn't have a support system at all. And during her journey in Harga, she finds a family. And Ari Aster mentions this in an interview as well. Danny finds a kind of family in Harga. However, you know, dysfunctional, but it's still a family. I mean, like most families, it's a bit dysfunctional, maybe more than normal families, but so her journey in Harga kind of starts from denial of the loss of her parents and her sister, but then she sees her sister in the mirror in the drug-fueled scene. And it's just a blink and you miss it moment. You see a sister and she goes away. And then she comes face to face with the ritual that everyone talks about, where the two old couple, they jump to their deaths. Right. And everyone is shocked. Not everyone. Of course, just the Anglo-American folk they are shocked. They're shocked. But the Harga people are like, they're not really, they don't really care about what's going on. I mean, they care, obviously, but they're not sad about what's happening. Only time they're sad is that because the man is suffering, he didn't die completely, he's suffering, and they're wailing, they're crying with him, as they will also do with Danny near the end of the film. And as I said, Danny finds this dysfunctional family, this family that kind of embraces her. I mean, if you look at the dance scene in the May Queen Festival, I mean, she's happy for the first time ever. She feels like she belongs somewhere. She belongs with people. And she's happy, she's dancing, and she's, you know, she's cared for. As Pelle says about Christian, he asks, do you feel held by him? Does he feel home to you? And that, I think those quotes are really important, because Danny doesn't feel any of it. And that's why she just runs away again, because she knows that this is the truth, and she denies it once again. But in the end of the film, after, you know, she sees Maya and Christian have sex, she just starts wailing. And I think it's not just about the death of, it's not just about the sex. She remembers the death of her parents, and she remembers what she lost. And that's really important, I think, for the film, because this is the moment where denial is about to go away. And when they ask if she chooses one from the village or Christian to be sacrificed, she just goes, Christian. She just chooses him to go under that, because she knows he's not family. He doesn't feel home to her. And at the end, I think there's just this crazy smile that everyone, I think everyone reads it as she just went ballistic. Yes, that may be true. She went ballistic because she lost her entire family, guys, remember? I mean, but I think it's also a kind of happy smile, because she now knows she will never be alone. She will have a family. She will have people that make her feel held. And that's something, as Pelle says, that's something we all deserve. That's something Danny also deserves.
Yeah, it's definitely, I think it's hard to read an afterlife to that film, because I think the point is her smile, as you say. Like, it is just the fact that she accepts. And whatever happens after that, you know, we can argue, but I think that's the point of the film, right? Now, it's interesting because, especially the really great thing about you choosing those both of those Ari Aster films, is that there seems to be like a clear contrast between them as well. Yeah. Whereas Midsommar seems to fit, it seems to really bloom around Danny. I feel like Hereditary has a lot of different moving parts, and I absolutely see why you used it for anger. It feels like anger is girding the entire film. But there's also a lot more going on, right? There's the witches. There's, you know, the fact that what's the name of the kid that dies? The girl? I forget her name.
Charlie.
Yeah, you know, Charlie doesn't die until I think like halfway through the film, you know, and then we have this first half of the film. So I guess, can you talk a little bit about how you feel all the other moving parts of Hereditary not only feeds into anger, but also into grief? Like, let's maybe like try to read it in its totality together. What would you say about it?
The first scene, it starts with the, you know, there's a black screen, and then we see letters, and it's a eulogy. It's a kind of like, death certificate. How can I say this? Yes, kind of like death speech, but it starts with someone obviously dying, and we then cut to the eulogy that Annie is speaking, and then we realize that Annie's mother is the one who died.
Right.
And we are expecting a normal eulogy, you know, a normal eulogy where, you know, the loved one talks fondly of the deceased. But what we get is a very angry and passive aggressive eulogy. And that alone tells us that there's something wrong with this grief process, because if you're talking shit about your dead mother at your funeral, there's something clearly wrong with your relationship to her. And Then we learn, of course, they go to the house, the husband and the Annie, and go, they go home, and she says, I don't feel sad, like I feel numb, I don't feel sad, what should I feel? And he just answers, you should feel whatever you want to feel, whatever you feel like. And because, you know, you cannot put, you cannot make someone's grief. Grief happens on its own. I mean, and everybody's grief is different, and everybody's grief is same at the same time. It's a very interesting thing. Our griefs resemble one another, but they are also very unique in their, for example, the grief over my grandmother is different for me, and it's different for my brother, it's different for my mother, of course, it's different for my aunt, it's different for everybody. And in this case, you are kind of you kind of have an understanding that Annie had a problem with her mother when she was alive. And we, of course, learn this through the entirety of the film that the mother was quite eccentric and occultist, very, very, very interesting persona. And then we like move through the film, and we realize that Annie is an artist, and she's a diorama artist, and diorama is basically making miniature versions of real life situations or whatever. She makes like dollhouses, and she's a really good artist, and there's a event coming up for, you know, for her new art, and she's stuck. She kind of has an artist block. And she starts making the final scene of her mother in the hospital. And you're like, this is so weird. Yeah. And for me, that's a classic memento mori. And memento mori is important in my dissertation as well. I talk about it a lot. And memento mori is something that reminds you that we are mortal. It's a reminder of mortality. And in olden times, they would put skulls on dinner tables. And how weird, but also how wicked. Can you imagine someone just puts a skull in while you're eating? And you're like, that seems weird. And okay. But of course, in this film, memento moris are, for me, dioramas that she's making. She makes another diorama, which is even more weird. And it's just that I think the breaking point is the death of Charlie. Right, yeah. Because that's the moment. I mean, she was already, I mean, she didn't like her mother that much, so she was grieving, but she wasn't grieving as in, you know, it wasn't really that much. She didn't feel anything really for her mother. But Charlie was a different case, because she was the one who said that Charlie should go with her brother. And that was a very terrible call that she couldn't take back, because of that call, she basically caused, not meaning to, she caused her daughter's demise. And what a demise. I mean, what a way to die, and what a way to find your daughter, you know, in the morning, in the car without her head. I mean, it's just, oh, it's such a brutal film. And of course, she becomes angry at herself at first. She becomes angry. But of course, she can't do anything to herself. So she has to find someone else to project that anger. And that person is, of course, the son. Peter was his name, I think. And Peter is the one that she sees as the culprit. And that dinner scene is very important, because no one is speaking and no one is saying a word. And like out of nowhere, she just goes ballistic And he just murmurs like, "Mom, do you have something to say to me?" And she's like, "Do you have something to say to me? Because, you know, you caused the death of your sister." I mean, he should have said something, but he also feels very guilty. I mean, you can see that. He's shocked, he's guilty, and he feels all of that. And he's also being haunted by something. And this guy has a lot of troubles as it is. So when she goes ballistic, she goes, "I cannot forgive because you cannot accept what you did." And that's really important, because grief, with grief comes acceptance. Like if the person that is guilty can't accept that they're guilty in this case, how can you forgive them? Like, it's impossible to forgive them, because they don't feel sorry, they don't feel guilty. And that was really important. And there are a lot of things about grief in the film as well. There is a support group, I think, is really important. And it was important for my research as well. She goes to a support group for survivors. And we learn that her father and her brother also killed themselves. And that's just, you're like, what? This family, I mean, they can't catch a break. Like, what's wrong? And she talks. Then we realize why she's mad at her mother. And then she talks a bit. But after that, she stops going to the meetings. But she basically meets this lady who's into mediums and occult and stuff. And she helps her. She helps her in a way. Yes, that's true. But of course, there is a hidden agenda. And spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Hereditary, this lady has a hidden agenda. She's one of the people who was in the cult with her mother. And basically, but she's also grieving. Because of her daughter, she lost someone, and she's also grieving. There's a lot of grief going around in the house. Oh, yeah. The dad, I mean, the dad, we don't talk about him a lot, played by Gabriel Byrne, and I think he plays with such a nuance that you understand that he feels torn between Peter and Annie, but also he misses her, Charlie, and tries to, you know, kind of live through his grief, but he can't catch a break because of Annie and Peter's ongoing, you know, dynamic. Yeah. And there's a lot of grief going on in the film, but afterwards, I mean, he dies. She dies, Peter becomes Paimon, and of course he dies too, in a way. And this film tells us that basically anger is not the way to go. And anger, you cannot hold on to your anger forever in grief. You have to kind of try to move on to the other stages and try to move on to acceptance. Because if you keep up with the anger, you're going to lose your head, as I also wrote in my dissertation. It's really important. Yeah, it's quite poignant that she loses her head. Yeah, rage and grief is so important for Hereditary. It sets the entire tone. I mean, the film is also very dark, but there are scenes where it is red, and red is cinematographically very, anger-like. Anger, when you think about red, your mind just goes anger. Yeah. And it is. There are a lot of scenes where red is used throughout the film, whereas Midsommar is in broad daylight, and there are like beautiful flowery clothes, beautiful like white sheets, and everything is so nice and beautiful. But also under that beauty, there is decay and there's weird stuff going on.
Both of them are like fables in a way, and like Midsommar in a way kind of gives like this toxic optimism, and Hereditary, as you say, is like a self-destruction. So it's really beautiful in that way. So my next question, I wanted to frame around Pet Sematary, but really I think this question goes for any of the films that you broke down as your thesis. And it's a question of like, you know, you make this really important point that a lot of horror scholarship hasn't focused on how grief is processed, even though death is central to the genre, right? But then there's this other thread where horror is supposed to be the manifestation of anxieties, right? So then my question is, when we then place your framework of like these films are about how we face grieving, which I absolutely believe and I agree with, and I agree with your interpretation, then where do you think the anxiety is placed? Is the anxiety placed on the grief itself, or is it placed on the process of the grief? Like, should I be anxious about the bargaining, or are we actually critiquing the very state of grief here?
Anxiety, I completely agree with you. Anxiety is, of course, very important in horror films. And it's everywhere, you know, where when you're watching a horror film, you're anxious. The characters are anxious. Also, I have to say that horror films are very in touch with the zeitgeist, with the time of spirit of the time. And they are basically a projection of the anxieties of the society at that time. And now I'm talking about 21st century horror films here. And 21st century is a place full of anxiety. I talk about this in my introduction. The thing that I think set all of these films in motion is the public displays of mourning, such as 9/11 and the funeral of Princess Diana in 1997. Because before that, as I said, Western Europe liked to leave their grief in behind closed doors. And after these events, because we watch people die on live television, I mean, how often does that happen? It was a very culturally, it was culturally very important moment, vital moment for the entirety of the planet. Because I was in Turkey, and I had just come from school, and I was watching the films, and just before my eyes, the towers, they were being destroyed, and I was shocked to the core. And I was in middle school or something like that. But I remember that I didn't go to the school after the news, because it was the lunch break. And after that, I didn't go to school because we were all shocked. We didn't know what to do with what we saw. And of course, we were face to face with death. And that was really important. And Princess Diana also died before our eyes. We saw that car crash. All of us saw that car crash. And these triggered public displays of grief. And people started to mourn on streets. They started to hold vigils on the streets. And that was really important. And Roland, the horror scholar, he asks in his book that if anything will happen after the events of the 9/11, you know, horror-wise. And I think this was the manifestation of it in horror, true horror fashion. It once again brought on our screen something very cultural and something very now. And we were all grieving. We were all trying to, you know, kind of come to terms with our grief and loss. And horror films were like, stop. Okay, I have a way. I have a way to help you. And I think these films, you know, bargaining and anger, depression and denial, and lastly, of course, acceptance, these are all about, you know, our anxieties in the modern world that something terrible might just be around the corner. I mean, look at the pandemic. Look at COVID-19. I mean, my family lost 5 people to COVID, and a lot of my friends lost a lot of family to COVID. And it's really a kind of, I think we will see more films about grief. I mean, recent films such as The Night House, I don't know if you guys heard of it, but
I did watch it.
You watched it, right? It's about grief. Another film about grief. Whenever now, I feel like it's kind of like deformity, occupational hazard, that I'm now looking at horror films and all I see is grief. I cannot accept the fact that, you know, like, all of these are about grief, guys. Come on. And yes, they are. They are about grief because they're showing their kind of manifestations of our anxieties. And our anxiety right now is about death and how close we are. We are just a breath away from dying from a pandemic. So it's really important that this anxiety, I think, will continue being projected onto the big screen. And we will see a lot more films about grief in the near future. I'm very sure about this.
Yeah, it definitely seems. Well, you know, also with the success of films like Midsommar, like Hereditary, you know, that tend to be more cerebral, I guess, in their presentation. So I think you're absolutely right. I think, and as you say, our current moment, it's hard not, I mean, we always talk about how cultural production reflects, you know, the societal moment. So it's only a matter of time. Now, what's interesting is you're absolutely right in the sense that most of your films, I mean, all of them were made in Anglo context. They were made in the 21st century, but one of them is a period piece. And it's really interesting with The Woman in Black, because again, like with all of your chapters, I see the argument clearly, but especially with The Woman in Black, I think it may be the only one where I'm like, can this argument then be lifted for other period horror pieces? And I'll tell you what I was thinking of. Your chapter reminded me of Hill House, all of the interpretations of Hill House and how, you know, that legend in and of itself is like about this haunting of and in the case that you argue it can be read as a depression. So do you mind talking a little bit about that, sort of about like this, I think you said like it's an Edwardian era, but like just generally, like how do you think about this idea of grief as depression in period horror?
It's set in Edwardian times, but it was written in 1983 and shot in the 21st century. So it's really, you would think that it's a gothic novel, right? But it's actually written in it's written in the 20th century, which is very interesting. I thought it was a gothic novel at first, but then I realized that, oh, this is from 83, come on. It was like 5 years before I was born. And it's really interesting. It's a fascinating piece because why this entire town called Crittenden Gifford is depressed. They are depressed because their children are dying horribly.
Yeah.
And literally, they are literally dying, and they know how, but they don't really know how. Like, they know that this ghost, whenever someone sees this ghost, a child will be taken, but they don't know how this, like, who is this, like, what's going on? Who is this ghost? Like, what's going on in this town? And then Arthur, as I said before, Arthur has dreams about his dead wife all the time throughout the entirety of the film. He has dreams, and we understand that he's he hasn't been himself after the demise of his wife during childbirth. Of all of the things that she could die from, she died at childbirth, and that's really important, I think. And she dies, and he has dreams, and then there is this child that is left behind, a child without a mother, and a child with a depressed father. Basically, he's painting something, and Arthur asks, like, why am I sad? Like, why did you paint me sad? And he just goes, the son just goes, because that's your face always looks like. And I don't know if I should laugh or cry for this kid and this man who is clearly clinically depressed. And then he goes to work, and we kind of get an understanding of what he's really like, because his boss is a terrible man, apparently. And he just says that if your performance doesn't go up, I will fire you. And he just like goes, after the death of your wife, you just stop working, and you just like not. Yeah, it's called grief, man. I mean, it happens, you know. It happens to people. If especially if you're not getting therapy, and if you're not getting help for this very tragic loss. And of course, it wasn't the thing in Edwardian era. You wouldn't go to, you know, doctors and psychotherapists for anything that happens to you. But you clearly see that this man is not well. And then he goes to Creating Gifford, and he comes face to face with a townsfolk who doesn't want him to be there. Like, he's like, why? Like, he doesn't understand. But whenever he mentions the Ian Marsh house, everyone is like, Ian Marsh house? Of course, I'm cleaning a glass right here. Ian Marsh house. You shouldn't go there. And everyone is like very cryptic and being mysterious and shit. And just say so. I mean, just say that there's something wrong with the house. Why are you giving this man a hard time for being there? He doesn't even want to be there. And of course, there's only one ally, Sam Daly. Sam Daly lost his son to this tragic event as well. He drowned. And his wife, Elizabeth, clearly is depressed, and just you see her just pushing a very empty cradle, and you're like, is she okay? She doesn't seem okay. I think she should see a doctor or two. And but their entire house is like a shrine to their dead son. And that's like the entire film, the eel marsh, the decay, and the, you know, the mise-en-scene, the black clothes, Arthur wears black, the woman in black obviously wears black, everyone wears black because it's a town in mourning, and everything about this film screams death, destruction, decay, and grief. And depression. You are depressed watching the film. There is mist all over the place. I mean, he said there is, of course, a kind of like marsh around the house, and it's just everything is like mud. There is mud all over the place, and everything about it screams depressed. And everything about it also screams gothic, and gothic is very important. If I have time, I would like to mention a little bit about Gothic and how it plays into our hands. And various studies, for example, like date the beginning of horror to Gothic literature. James Twitchell states that, you know, modern works of art, artificial horror, originated in the late 18th century discovery that by inducing extreme feelings of dreadful pleasures, both print and illustration could arouse and exploit powerful feelings deeper than the human spirit. And many scholars believe that the Gothic novel was born out of the Enlightenment repression. As feelings were replaced by reason in Western Europe, the creative passion found a way out in the form of Romanticism. And so the Gothic novel, as I say, was alive. And that becomes a Freudian uncanny in the Gothic, you know, both familiar and unfamiliar. Haunted homes, you know, like Ilmarsh House, grieving families, like the Griffin Gifford people, along with the otherworldly spirits, take center stage. And Joseph and Tucker argue that the Victorian age is in mourning for lost fixtures in the world and of the spirit, which the acceleration of a coveted yet feared modernity had swept away. And, you know, even Queen Victoria herself is known for her very public grief in the aftermath of her husband, Prince Albert's death. And Victorian age, this obsession with morbidity, decay, death and mourning, both the culture and the works of art. As I mentioned before, Elizabeth Bronfen talks about death by proxy, which is something like we experience death through, you know, someone else and through at a safe distance. I think you can see that clearly in The Woman in Black. The Woman in Black shows you many deaths. Just as you think that Arthur will be safe with his son Joseph, they die. And you're like,
so frustrating.
No, that can't happen. They have to be happy. But this is different in the play. In the play, Arthur doesn't die. Oh. And yeah, that's very interesting that they changed it for my benefit. For my benefit, because that shows that Arthur is also suffering from survivor's guilt, because he now lives the life that his wife will never be able to experience. Mm. And he feels guilty because he's the one who's there and she's not there anymore. So just as he helps Jenny find her son, we think that everything will be fine and they'll go home, but no. Jenny says no, because grief will never go away. It will never leave you, and it will take you to your grave, literally in this case. And but at last we see, you know, three of them, you know, mother, child, and father, going happily into the white light, and maybe it's a kind of happy ending. Who knows?
The really interesting part about choosing the Babadook for acceptance, which, by the way, I think, as you say, it's like really obvious, the same way that Midsommar is really obvious about denial, is the fact that the Babadook has also sort of been like repurposed as this joyful thing, you know, obviously with the LGBT community, you know, we love making everything gay. But I mean, there's also that opening in the film itself with acceptance, because, you know, acceptance does, you know, both in your thesis, but also in the framework overall, it's the final step. Like, okay, this is it with the grief. And earlier when you were talking about how we deal with grief, I just heard this, I think it was a quote from Frank Ocean, where he said that grief is the love that we don't get to express in reality. And I think to sort of begin to tie all of this together, do you think that acceptance, especially as it's portrayed in horror, does lead to a certain joy? Or do you think that is something we put onto grief to make it more palatable? Do you mind sort of extricating this a bit?
I think it's not the former, but the latter. Death, let's talk about death a little bit. I mean, death is the one thing, along with birth, that we will all experience if you're not vampires. I mean, if you're vampires, it's cool. If you're zombies, it's cool. But apart from that, birth and death are the only two things that it is certain that we will all go through. Mm. And birth causes joy in most cases, but death is different. I mean, it's the same natural phenomena. I mean, you're born, you come to this world, and then you leave this world, which is very natural. I mean, if you, for example, go to someone's house as a guest, you come and they are like happy, and then you leave, which is like you can't stay there forever. At one point, they will be like, maybe you should go. I mean, at one point that will happen, and that is, I think, a very natural thing. And we somehow, I think, I don't know when, maybe with enlightenment, maybe before that, we sort of, because ancient burial rituals and ancient mourning periods were more acceptant of like of death, and they didn't really think too much about the death after they die. But this is not the same in our modern world. We care a lot. We are scared, anxious about dying a lot. We are scared about our loved ones dying, because then we will be alone. And it is some kind of like, death is kind of pushed aside, out of the home, out of the domestic area. You know, I talk a little bit in my dissertation about funeral homes. I mean, before then, everything happened in your house. Right. But then after the Enlightenment, it started to, you know, go away to funeral homes where you can't see the dead, where you can only see them after their makeup, you know, after they're, you know, dollied up. And this is really interesting that we have to do makeup to dead people, and they're dead. I mean, let's accept this fact. They're dead and gone. You cannot make them like look lively. There's no life in that person anymore. And I think grief and death is very unacceptable for people, general people. We want to avoid it as much as we can, as fast as we can. But we can't do that. It's not possible. We have to accept it. I mean, just as I said before, just as we accept that a baby is born, we should accept. We have to learn to accept that people will also die. And horror films, I think, help us do that. Horror films, especially horror films about grief, show us that you can accept. It's okay to accept. It's okay to say that person is gone and they live forever. Burial rituals and other rituals, they're rooted in the myths. And myths create meaning. And if there is meaning in something, it's easier to accept. And horror films about death, I think, do that. They create meaning to grief and death. And if we find the meaning, it will be easier for us to accept that we cannot run from death. We cannot escape that. And we cannot also escape the death of our loved ones. They will die at one point. And acceptance is really important. And in Babadook, acceptance is the final stage. And Amelia doesn't celebrate the birthday of her son, Sam, because that's the same day that the father was, you know, killed in a car crash, Oscar. And but after, like, before the ending of the film, we see that they celebrate the birthday on the actual date. And that's a very joyful thing. That's a happy thing, because that shows us that they're coming to terms with, you know, grief. They're coming to terms with death. And that's really important. And we should all, I mean, I'm not saying let's all be happy about that. That's crazy. I mean, we cannot do that. And that wouldn't be healthy as well. That wouldn't be sane. But what I'm saying that we should accept it. We should accept and try to move on as much as we can. That's the only way to go forward. And horror films thankfully help us do that.
What I would like to ask you is, you know, you wrote this great dissertation and, you know, it had,
you
sort of like already addressed this a little bit, but I'm going to ask it more directly. So you wrote it and it's beautiful. Is there any questions you have left over after you finished it, or questions that you have in the modern day today that you would like to address or see others explore?
Yeah, and thankfully a couple of wishing houses are interested in the dissertation.
That's
so
awesome.
You might, yeah, thank you. I think I would write more, finish all my questions as you ask. I still have questions. I still watch films and I'm like, oh, that should have been in the dissertation. And I want to add them to my list of the films. I will put all of them to the book that I'm writing. I started writing a bit and try to expand this thing, the idea that I started in the dissertation. There is one thing, of course, I talk a little bit about COVID because it was the beginning of COVID when I wrote the dissertation. Yeah. And now we are still in this mode, in this COVID mode, and it sounds like and looks like it will never go away. Yeah. So I think I would talk a lot more about the pandemic as well in my dissertation, because I think it's very important, and because it feeds into our anxieties, as you said, and horror takes the anxiety of the society right away. It's never out of step. It always catches up with the times. And that's why I love horror. I would like to talk more about the pandemic in my dissertation, and I will in the book, hopefully.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait for that to come out. You have to keep us updated.
Thank you. Of course.
My ending note probably is when I went to Final Girls Film Fest in Berlin, there was this film, You Are Not My Mother by Kate Borland. Probably got her last name wrong. But when I was watching this film, I thought of your dissertation. So if you haven't seen it yet.
No, I haven't seen it.
Please, I think like it's doing the festival rounds right now, but it was one of those films where I was like, I don't think I've seen grief dealt with this way. And probably because the death was almost metaphorical. And I don't think that's a spoiler. I think that's like in the trailer. It really makes us think like how do we even define grief, right? And I think it's so exciting that you're taking on this. I think it's an important thing to discuss in horror studies, and I'm so stoked that you came on the podcast to talk about it, because I think it's really
I am very happy to be invited. It was a pleasure to talk to you. You're a really great host. And it was because death and, you know, death, dying and grief, these are not really, you know, bright subjects that you want to talk about every day. In great company, it's easier to talk about this stuff.
No,
but they're dark. I know, but it's important that we talk about them because it's part of life as well.
It totally is important. As someone, like, I think I have death spirals every day. I think that a conversation like this actually really helps me. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.